All right. We'll go ahead and get started. I guess for those of you who have not had me for 1110, let me just say I'm Dr. Reeves, and I'm also a professor in this department. And if Dr. Denny didn't explain what's going on with 1110 to y'all this semester, what's happened is this semester we peeled off one of the lab sections and ran an experimental section where the experimental section did a different design project using a wireless Lego car. So it's a little bit different from what y'all did, but basically the same thing. So we've been running these two classes in parallel. Anyway, we use a pretty similar structure. We have professional development meetings and that sort of thing too. So one of the things that frustrates me a little bit is that all these topics that we hit on throughout the semester, you just barely scratch the surface. And so one of those, of course, is ethics, and you just barely scratch the surface on that. But not only that, I have another type of frustration in that I think that there are some things that could be said from a particular perspective, obviously a Christian perspective, that I don't really feel like is my place to talk about in a class that I'm requiring people to go to. But for a class or for an extra lecture or extracurricular thing that's voluntary, I have no problem in talking a little more specific about these kinds of things. But basically what I want to do is just talk about ethics specifically from a Christian perspective. It may not be something that you hear fleshed out very well, maybe definitely not in an ENGR 1110, but maybe not even in an ethics class, just because it's a little more generic than that, although certainly I imagine they would at least touch on some of this stuff. So let me just begin by talking about one particular example of an ethical issue. Of course, we all kind of still have the election ringing in our ears, and one of the issues that was knocked around a little bit was the issue of stem cell research. It turns out that in the last election, there was a huge difference between John Kerry and George Bush on stem cell research, but there wasn't quite the same level of difference between Obama and McCain. Obama supports embryonic stem cell research, and to the best of what I could find from anything he has said publicly, he has not qualified his support of or how that ought to look in any particular way. McCain also supported embryonic stem cell research, but he was very clear in opposing creating embryos for research purposes. Okay? Now, I only bring this up because this is a hot topic in our country and in our culture today. If you look at surveys, you'll see that surveys show that 65% of Americans are actually in favor of stem cell research. So if you ask them about it in that generic sort of way, you'll find most people are in favor of stem cell research. That number actually was from a survey a few years ago. It's probably actually increased some since then, my guess. But if you ask it another way, you'll find that a majority of Americans are opposed to destroying an embryo to harvest stem cells. So there may be a general support for stem cell research, but not necessarily at the cost of destroying an embryo. At least that was a few years ago, that was the consensus. So the question is, how do we decide on an issue like this? There's several different ways that we can approach this. One is we can take some surveys, which I just appealed to a couple of surveys. The problem with surveys is that people are changeable. What I just said was that, you know, a few years ago it was 65% for one of those and a majority for the other one. But it may not be 65% anymore. It might be higher, it might be lower. The other one may not be a majority anymore. I don't know. But the question is, should morality be based on what is popular at a given time? And I think we would be pretty quick to say no, that's not the case. We can think of things that have happened at various times in history that were popular at a given time, and people look back on it and say, that was terrible. So that's not a particularly good way to decide the question. What about rational discussion? Of course, we all like to be rational. We'd rather have a discussion than have a war over our differences on these things. So in that sense, that's a good thing. But when we have this rational discussion, what principles are we going to bring to the table to make the decision? Reason alone is not capable of making decisions without bringing some specific principles in there to talk about things like contradictions and so on. A principle such as each person should have a right to decide his own fate is one that seems to be pretty popular these days, but it's not a universally held opinion. So if it's not a universally held opinion, how do we break the tie, so to speak? How do we resolve that when different people have different ideas about that? And then another question is, where does that come from? Why should we accept that as a principle that we use in a rational discussion? Okay, so what I'm going to do is basically a critique, or at least to start with, a critique of what I call naturalistic ethics. And by naturalistic ethics, what I mean is ethical principles that are grounded in a purely natural understanding of the world. That is, that God is not relevant to the issue, and it's simply a matter of using our own reason and deducing things from what we observe around us, apart from the idea of a revelation. So that's basically what I mean by naturalistic ethics. So I want to talk about some problems that I see with naturalistic ethics. First of all, in naturalistic ethics, there's no authority. And we can talk about things that seem to be good or things that seem to be maybe not so good, but we have a problem in that we can never bridge the gap from what is to what ought to be. Now, an example of this is, suppose that we did a study, a detailed scientific study, and we found that people who are married and stay together tend to be happier. Okay, so that sounds pretty good. So we might recommend, okay, it's good to get married and stay married. All right. Well, what if we also did another study and we found that people who are a part of a crime family tend to be happier? They have more control over their destiny. They tend to have sense of authority and success and that sort of thing. More money available than most people, that sort of thing. So they tend to be happier too. Well, those are simply two descriptions of things, aren't they? But they don't necessarily tell us that's the way it ought to be. Just because, I mean, we tend to hear that when we hear something like marriage, because we generally have a positive view of marriage. And so we'll say, oh yeah, okay, good. Well, that gives me good reason to say, you know, I want to get married and I want to stay married. But when we hear that say people in crime families are generally happier, we go, whoa, wait a minute. Now, okay, maybe that's the way it is, but that's not necessarily the way it ought to be, right? That doesn't necessarily recommend to us to go out and become part of a crime family or start a crime family or something like that. So those two things, where we do this study and we find out what happens as a result, are simply ways of describing what is. But they don't necessarily tell us what ought to be. So that's one of the problems with naturalistic ethics. Another problem is inadequate information. When we look at the complexities of ethical dilemmas, there's just not enough information in naturalistic ethics, and we're going to look at some of the specific ethical systems as we go on here. And there's just no way to properly assess the many competing values when we begin to deal with an ethical dilemma. So those are the two main problems that I see with naturalistic ethics. There's just no authority, and there's inadequate information. All right. Let me explain, though, why I believe that naturalistic ethics is partially successful. I mean, I want to recognize that people who do ethics and people who think about ethics, even if they don't admit that ethical principles come from God, they often arrive at pretty good answers and pretty good decisions. And that needs to be explained. And so my explanation from a Christian perspective is that naturalistic ethics is partially successful, first of all, because everyone must live in a world that's created by God. And so the very fact that we live in a world that's created by God forces our thinking about ethics to have some sort of a reality check. Even though we may not admit that that's influencing the way we think about ethics, it still does. We're sort of always bumping up against the reality of God's world and God's creation. The second reason why I think naturalistic ethics is partially successful is that we simply can't escape the fact that humans are made in the image of God. We may not admit we're made in the image of God, but we still are, and we're still going to tend to think that way. We're wired that way, to think that way, whether we want to or not, whether we admit we are or not. So I think that's another reason why naturalistic ethics is partially successful. It often mirrors what you might come up with from a Christian perspective, even though there's no admission that that's what's going on. And then I think there's a third thing that's true, particularly in our culture. Maybe not you can't say this about all cultures, but our culture is heavily influenced by a Christian heritage. And I mean for, a couple thousand years now. And so it's deeply ingrained in the way we think about what's good and what's bad, what's important, what's not, what's right and what's wrong. All these things influence our way of thinking about ethics, even if we may not, have learned or bought into all the so-called Sunday school answers or Bible answers or something like that. And so I think that naturalistic ethics tends to borrow from the influence of Christianity in the culture, at least our culture. Okay, so now I want to talk about the fact that we're inescapably ethical. And why is that? First of all, I'm going to just kind of prove that to you. How do you react when somebody does you wrong? Now, you may say everyone should be able to do whatever they feel like doing, or that each person should be able to decide his own ethical principles. And that may sound good in theory, but what if somebody walked up to your brand new car and threw a brick on the hood? Okay, all of a sudden now, this very tolerant idea of what other people can do has encroached into your space. They've just messed up your brand new car. All of a sudden, you will become the most staunch absolutist. That person needs to be punished, right? Because we just can't escape the fact that we recognize an injustice has been done. My brand new, beautiful car, they just threw a brick on the hood. They deserve punishment. They deserve to be drugged down the street or something like that. So we react that way because we've been wrong. And we immediately recognize then that there's some principle there that they should have known about. And they didn't they should recognize, but they didn't respect. And they didn't follow. So that every time when we're done wrong, we have that deep sense of having been wronged. What we're saying is that person was accountable for this same ethical principle that I believe and that I think they violated. So it's not just purely me, my own personal opinion, but they're responsible for it too. Okay? Now here's another thing that takes a little bit of explaining. I hope I can get this across to you. What if we went outside and we started talking about the sky? And you said, "Man, look at that sky. That is a beautiful blue sky." And I said, "That sky's not blue. It's pink." And you look at me like, "Are you insane? That the sky's blue. It's obvious that it's blue. Come here, so-and-so. Tell me, is that sky blue or is it pink?" And so-and-so would say, "It's blue." And I'm sitting here going, "Nah, it's pink." So then you pull out your light sensor, your spectrometer, and you measure the light coming from the sky, and you say, look, see, it peaks at blue. That's a blue, that's a spectrum in there. It peaks at blue, so that tells you right there, that's a blue sky. And I go, pink. Well, by that time, you're starting to get angry with me, aren't you? Because I'm not just being, we're not just interpreting the facts differently, or it's not just a neutral matter of two different opinions about something. In your mind, you have brought enough evidence to the table that I ought to be convinced, right? And at that point, I'm just being hard-headed. I'm being foolish. Okay? And you want to slap me, right? Over something so obvious as that. Well, that's because we all have this sense that if I bring enough evidence to you to believe something, to convince you, you ought to be convinced. In other words, you have an ethical obligation to accept things that are true. Now, we might disagree over what's true and, you know, what's valid evidence and all that, but I think we all understand that when we make a good argument, we expect people to accept the argument and not just go on and go, I don't believe it. We don't do that. We would find that to be not just stupid, but we would find that to be offensive and wrong. Okay, and likewise, if somebody brings evidence to us, we feel obligated. We may not like what they say, but we still feel obligated to believe it if it's really true or if it seems to be true. And so the whole idea of that there's an ethic for truth is deeply built into us that we believe that if we make a good argument, someone should accept it. And if someone makes a good argument to us, then we should accept it. So we have an ethic for truth. And the funny thing is, those who would say there are no ethical principles or everything is relative would still argue and try to argue and point and prove to us that everything is relative. And even in the process of doing that, they're proving that they believe there's an ethic for truth. That is, that I'm obligated to accept what they just this argument that they just made. And they might get frustrated with me for saying, no, I believe in absolutes. Well, the very fact that they're arguing tells me they have an absolute. And that is, they believe that people should accept what is true. Okay, or at least as they understand what is true. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, then the third thing is, why is it that you feel a sense of obligation or maybe guilt if you don't meet your obligation concerning your behavior, even if nobody is watching? And I think we probably all experienced this, where we did something that we felt like was wrong, and then we feel guilty about it. Or we do something maybe that wasn't so convenient, but we did it anyway, even though nobody was watching, nobody would ever find out, just because we thought that's what we ought to do. It's not a matter of somebody's going to smack you, or you're going to get in trouble, or you're going to have to pay a fine or something like that. You just do it because you have this deep sense of obligation that has nothing to do with being caught or suffering a specific consequence. And I think that, again, demonstrates how inescapably ethical we really are. Okay, so now I want to go back, and now that I've sort of critiqued naturalistic ethics, I want to talk about Christian ethics and hopefully show that it answers some of these concerns. The first thing is, Christian ethics obviously has adequate authority, that is, assuming that God is real. At least the explanation makes sense, and that is that God, as a creator, has a certain right over his creatures. That's what the authority is. So there's no question of going from what is to what ought to be, because God says what ought to be. That's the source of authority, is God himself. Okay? This sense of obligation that we have. Why do we have that sense of obligation? And the reason why we have that sense of obligation is that God is personal. He is a personal creator. And so the idea of obligation is, it's relational. You know, we don't just have obligation to some generic something out there, but we have an obligation to person. Now, I can just imagine what would happen if you're kind of thinking about, you got a lot of work to do over the Thanksgiving break, and you say, I think I'm just going to stick around here. And then your mama calls up and says, are you coming home for Thanksgiving? You say, Mom, I don't think so. I've just got too much work to do. Oh, please come home. I've already bought the turkey. I've planned all this. All the relatives are coming over. I'm just going to be heartbroken if you're not there. This would be the first time ever that you weren't at our Thanksgiving dinner. It would just break my heart. Well, what are you going to think? No biggie. Well, I'll just stay here. No, that's going to move you, isn't it? You're going to start thinking, how can I work it out so I can get my work done and please Mama? I gotta please Mama. Okay, you sense this obligation to her because you have a relationship with her, right? You don't want to disappoint your mother. You're connected to her. You have a personal relationship. And that's where I think the sense of obligation comes from. The reason why we sense an obligation is because God is personal, and in some sense we have a personal relationship with Him as our Creator. And it's not just that there's a law or a rule somewhere. Now, if there was a rule somewhere that came down from on high and it sort of seemed disconnected from people and everything that says all Auburn students must go home for Thanksgiving, well, you probably wouldn't. That wouldn't make you feel very obligated, would it? I mean, you might be worried that the Auburn police would be after you or something if you were on campus, but you wouldn't say, man, I just would feel really guilty if I didn't go home because, after all, the law of Auburn says you must go home for Thanksgiving. No, that wouldn't move you much at all because it would be very impersonal. But when Mama says come home for Thanksgiving, all of a sudden that means a lot, doesn't it? All right, well, the third thing is that Christian ethics has adequate information. First of all, God's image in us helps shape and inform our decisions, the way we react to ethical issues. That's kind of the inside thing. But then on the outside, we have God's revelation to us, both in nature and more clearly in the Bible. Okay? So that's why we would have adequate information to deal with the complexity of ethical dilemmas. Another thing that I haven't really even addressed from a naturalistic perspective, but that is, why is it that ethical dilemmas seem so difficult sometimes? Well, I think Christian ethics can explain why there are ethical dilemmas. Why is it that it's difficult? Well, there are two points here. One has to do with the inside, and the other has to do with the outside. Okay, there's an inside explanation and an outside explanation. The inside explanation of Christianity is that our own sin, our own wiring that makes us tend toward evil decisions and a certain blindness to truth and rightness, those things create confusion about ethical obligations. So we're kind of stumbling around a little bit in the dark, and we don't necessarily even want to know the right answer sometimes. I think we probably all could admit that there have been times like that where kind of knew, but we didn't really want to know what was right in a situation. Well, that's the inside explanation. The outside explanation is that this creation is not the way God originally intended for it to be set up. We're in a world now that is cursed because of the presence of sin in the world. This is a Christian explanation for suffering and what we might call unwanted consequences in ethics. And so this curse creates unwanted consequences so that when we often face situations where either way we choose, we might be choosing between doing the right thing and suffering for it, or maybe two types of suffering or something like that. So if it weren't for that situation, the outside situation, we would never have a dilemma. The right thing to do would always be the most pleasurable and most blessed thing to do. Okay, but right now, it's not that way. So we face sometimes some difficulties just because of the consequences of our choices. Okay, so now here's where I do kind of a run through of some of the most common ethical systems and critique them a little bit from a Christian perspective. So I'm ordering them from fewest to most in terms of absolutes.
That's how I've organized this. So I'm going to start off with no absolutes. What about an ethical system that has no absolutes? Well, you might call that relativism. And there are all kinds of shades of relativism, but there's kind of a gist to all of them. And I would say that relativism is logically impossible to live with. We simply cannot do or say or think much of anything without immediately contradicting that idea. We may say that we're relativists, but we very quickly prove otherwise. So let me just think about a couple of different ways of expressing relativism. One, probably a stronger way of expressing relativism, that this is usually the way we want to express it when we're the one being criticized. Like, for example, there's been lots of loud shouting and stuff in California over that Proposition 8 about same-sex marriage. And those who wanted that proposition to fail have been yelling and screaming at Christians, this, you have no right to impose your morality on me. Okay? You have no right to impose your morality on me. Well, wait a minute. Let's look at that statement. The very statement, you have no right to impose your morality on me, is a rule, isn't it? It's an absolute rule. It's a rule that the person who says it expects others to follow. So isn't that kind of an absolute? It's an absolute that I'm imposing on you. I'm saying, you have no right. You may not. You should not impose your morality on me. If you do that, you're violating an ethical principle that I believe and that you ought to believe. Right? So immediately, right out of the gate, that kind of relativism just contradicts itself. Okay? Then there's, you might say, okay, well, I see that's a little too strong. Let's suppose that we back up a little bit and say it in a little less confrontational way. Why don't we say this? Each person can define his own morality. Okay? Well, let's unpack that a little bit. Each person can define his own morality. That means I'm giving you permission to define your own morality, and I expect you to give me that permission. I mean, normally that's the way it works. So what if that person says, no, you can't define your own morality, or I'm expecting you to do such and such. You'll say, wait, no. Each person can define his own morality, therefore I can define my own morality, and that's a rule too. I have permission. And you have no right, again, it just kind of boils down, you have no right to tell me I don't have that permission. And so, again, there's a conflict there over supposedly no absolutes and then the way that actually plays out. So even though it appears that a person is trying to back away from absolutes with those two statements themselves are actually ethically loaded. So you can't really even say those statements without, in a sense, imposing some kind of ethical standard on somebody else. Okay? Not to mention the fact that both of these also assume an ethic for truth. Remember we talked about that a few minutes ago. The idea that if I make a case to you, you should accept that case. If I make a good, compelling, logical case to you, you should accept it. And if you don't, you're being hard-headed and stubborn, and you should be kicked in the pants. Right? So if somebody says this second one, if nothing else, what they're expecting is that the other person should respond to that statement because they ought to receive truth when they hear it. Okay? At least that's, from the perspective of the person speaking. All right. So let's go on the systems with one absolute. There are several of these. Some of them are pretty similar, but let me just kind of lay them out. One of them is called situation ethics. If you've had an ethics class, you've seen this before. Kant's categorical imperative. Sounds really scary, but it's pretty simple. Utilitarianism. WWJD. Probably seen some bracelets and shirts and things like that. And that's kind of
it was a fad of a few years ago that's kind of winding down a little bit, but it stands for what would Jesus do. And then the last one is let your conscience be your guide. So I'm going to talk about each of these, and if you haven't written all that down and want to get it, you'll have that opportunity. Okay, let's start with situation ethics. In its simplest form, situation ethics just says, always do the most loving thing. That is the one ethic of situation ethics. Okay? Well, the first thing we have to ask is why? Where does that come from? Why should we do the most loving thing? What makes that always the right thing to do? What makes that work all the time? There's really no justification for it. Purely on a naturalistic basis, anyway. Another question we can ask about situation ethics, how can we know what is most loving? See, a lot of different people have a lot of different ideas about what's loving. This morning, my one-year-old he has a cold or something, and so his nose was all crusty and gunky and drippy and everything, and I took a wet washcloth and I went like this all over his face to try to get it cleaned up and everything, and he's like, ah! You know, he thought I was suffocating him or something. I don't know what it is about one-year-olds, but they absolutely hate to have their nose wiped. Just hate it. At least the ones that have my genes hate it. And you would have thought that I was sawing his nose off or something. Well, he didn't think that I was doing a very loving thing. But of course, my understanding of it was that, yes, I was doing a loving thing. I was trying to do something that would help him be more comfortable in the long run. Not to mention the fact that I didn't want it all over my sleeve, so I was doing something loving to myself too, and everybody else. Okay, another thing is, how can we criticize the actions of others? If all this is purely subjective, then how can I say that what you were doing was not loving? If you're defining love as in your own understanding, and you're doing this by your own understanding, then who am I to criticize? I can't tell what's in your heart. I can't tell what your motives were about whether you were doing a loving thing or not. And then kind of following along with that is how can we define justice? Justice has to do with objective standards of right and wrong, or objective standards of behavior. And if it's purely a matter of doing a loving thing, that's a purely subjective test. So we can't get it out into the open and say, is it okay to shoot somebody? Well, you know, you can imagine situations where somebody would say, yeah, it is right to shoot somebody who's about to, you know, blow up a restaurant or something like that. And then, you know, others might say not. But the point is, we've got to get down to the specific rules and not just say, well, they did it because they were loving. That's not good enough. That's not enough information there. All right. One of the problems with situation ethics is that it denies that there are some non-negotiable specifics when it comes to expressing love. And then, again, from a Christian perspective, Jesus said, he didn't just leave it purely at the level of love. He said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. So to him, loving would be expressed in some very specific ways. You'll keep my commandments. Now, with every one of these, I want to point out what I would call a grain of truth, because this is what I think kind of keeps this thing going, at least from a Christian perspective. There is a grain of truth here, a big one. And that is, and it's recognized by the Bible, you shall love the Lord God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. It's the greatest commandment, and the second like it. So the Bible recognizes that loving is supremely important, but the Bible does not deny that there are some more ethical principles behind that, or below it, you might say. Or maybe I should say, more specifically, unpacking it. All right. Okay, so the next one is Kant's categorical imperative. And what this says is that an action is ethical only if I can, with consistency, will it to be universally acted upon. And that's kind of a technical sounding way of explaining this, but let me read that again and then try to unpack that a little bit. An action is ethical only if I can, with consistency, will it to be universally acted upon. The basic idea is, what if everybody acted like me? Would that work? Could we live together if everybody acted the way I did, the way I do? So again, why should we accept this principle? I can't think of any logical basis for this principle except that you've already accepted this principle. And then you can say, well, that's consistent to accept this principle. But that's circular reasoning. Also, this particular absolute implies a hidden set of values. What you don't think about maybe on the surface is that once you try to unpack this, you say, well, there's certain things here that are being affirmed, and I'm not sure why. So, for example, what is with consistency? And why is consistency important? Now, we all kind of like consistency, at least in other people. Kind of predict what they are going to do, and hopefully it's consistently good, that kind of thing. But why is that a good thing? Why should we shoot for consistency? All right. There's a grain of truth in this one, and again, a big grain of truth, and I think this is captured in the golden rule. Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So I think that's basically saying what Kant's categorical imperative says. That is a way of thinking about ethics, that I shouldn't be doing things to other people that I wouldn't want them doing to me. And on the positive side, I should treat people the way I want them to treat me. So there is a grain of truth. It's just not the only thing that Christian ethics says. It's just one perspective on it. Okay, so then the next single absolute system is called utilitarianism. Utilitarianism says, do that which will bring about the greatest good. And again, that sounds pretty good on the surface. Certainly would like to bring about the greatest good. But now we are immediately confronted with this question, how do we define the greatest good? That's a pretty nebulous concept. It also forces a certain kind of omniscience upon us. How in the world can we tell whether something is going to bring the greatest good or not? And let's think specifically about the future. You know, determining the greatest good has to do with being able to foresee the consequences of your actions, right? How is that going to play out? Well, we can't do that. At least, I mean, we can sort of guess in some cases, and in some cases guess pretty well, but all the ramifications of our decisions, we can't tell that. There's no way we could do that. So it puts us in the position of forcing us to try to predict the future in order to make a judgment call. And it also puts us in the position that if we fail to see certain consequences, then it can bring a lot of guilt feelings. You may have grown up in a household where every time there's a mistake, an inquiry is done to see why you didn't foresee that. That can be a pretty rough place to live, because then every single thing has to be, you know, why didn't you foresee that? Well, is every consequence foreseeable by a finite human being? No, I don't think so. And the bottom line of utilitarianism is that it's basically saying that the end justifies the means. Now, when we put it that way, all of a sudden our warning flags go up a little bit, and we say, not just because the result that I'm after is good doesn't mean that I can justify any way of getting there. So, but that's essentially what utilitarianism boils down to. Because if you say, I think that it would be ultimately bring the greatest good if we killed off all the weak people in our society or something like that. Well, you might make that argument that in some way it brings about the greatest good, but that doesn't mean it's okay to do that. The price of getting there is not acceptable. Okay. But I think there is a grain of truth in utilitarianism, and that is that the greatest good, according to the Bible, is the glory of God.
So we have a way or a measure of the greatest good, and that is the glory of God. And God is glorified when we obey Him in specific ways, in the specific ways that He's commanded. So we're not denying, a Christian would not be denying that we ought to pursue the greatest good. It's just that the definition of the greatest good is defined in a specific way, and then how to get there is defined in a specific way. Okay. So again, that has a big grain of truth to it. Well, here's another one. What would Jesus do? Now, let me just qualify this by saying I don't think it's wrong to ask what would Jesus do, and I think that can be a pretty helpful question to ask in certain situations. But the problem comes when this becomes a standalone ethical system, as though you can make all your decisions just by asking that. It's basically, if this becomes a single absolute system, it's basically a Christianized version of situation ethics. Because I think we would say Jesus would do the most loving thing. So then we're just back down to, you know, what would Jesus do? How would Jesus do the most loving thing? If you think of this, again, as a single absolute ethical system, then you're ignoring all the specific instructions in the Bible that are put there for our information. So this could never stand alone, even though it might be a helpful question to sort of maybe expose our motives or think about it in a new light or something like that, but it can't stand by itself. The Bible would never allow that to stand by itself. Okay. And then a third problem with this, let me kind of squeeze in a third one and then make that one the fourth one. It also forces us to think very subjectively about what Jesus is like. Jesus was a real person. And we can't just have this sort of totally subjective idea that Jesus must have been just a really nice person or something like that. And so we come up with this, our own vision of what Jesus must have been like, and then use that vision to determine what we're going to do. Okay? That's a huge liability of this. As opposed to going to what the Bible says Jesus was like and what Jesus wanted and making our decisions from there. Okay, so then the last one here is this ignores the uniqueness of the person and mission of Christ. He was not just anybody else. He had a unique mission. He was a unique person. He had unique abilities and insights and things like that. So, you know, you've probably heard the kind of typical ethical dilemma. You go to the door. There is a gun-toting maniac at your door shouting, is your roommate at home? I'm going to kill him. Now, do you tell the truth and he rushes in and shoots and kills your roommate? Or do you tell a lie that your roommate is not there so that he'll go away? Okay, that's a typical kind of dilemma that people scratch their heads over in an ethics class. Well, I always like to say, well, maybe Jesus had some options available to him that we don't have in that situation. Maybe he would turn the gun into a loaf of bread. That's not an option that we have. Okay, so we can't just always say, what would Jesus do? Because in that situation, we immediately run into a situation where we can't do what Jesus might do. And of course, how would we know what he would do in that particular situation? But Jesus had a unique role that we don't have. And so the decisions, the specific calling and decisions that he would make might be different from us. Okay. And then the last one in the single ethic category, single absolute category, would be what I sometimes call the Jiminy Cricket ethic, which says, let your conscience be your guide. Well, the conscience is merely the faculty of moral judgment. It depends on how you define conscience, but my understanding of conscience is that it is simply sort of the
intellectual machinery that we use to come to a moral decision. And so to say, let your conscience be your guide, would be like saying, I'm trying to decide whether to buy this particular stock or not, and say, I know what I'll do. I'll let my computer analyze it. Now, I think all of us know enough about computers to know that you don't just go to your computer and punch a button and let the computer analyze it. You've got to have some software that does something on the computer. And depending on how the software is written, you can imagine coming up with lots of different recommendations on whether to buy that stock or not. It's not just the hardware that controls that, it's the software and all the assumptions that go into that software. Okay, so likewise, the principles upon which conscience acts must still be determined. So conscience is a faculty of moral judgment, but that conscience uses principles to make decisions. It's not just this completely subjective thing that somehow a decision comes out about whether something's good or not. It's based on some principles. Another problem with this idea, let your conscience be your guide, is that some people have hardened consciences. Some people have smashed computers. So if that's the bottom line, then we're in trouble. Their consciences aren't working right. Doesn't mean it's okay. Just because their conscience tells them it's okay, there are people that can shoot and kill somebody and they don't feel any remorse at all. That doesn't make it okay. I think that, you know, from a subjective perspective, from inside ourselves, our conscience is the way that we come to these decisions. And so we can't go against our conscience, because that is the bottom line on how we process information. But we must put the right data and the right principles into our conscience so that our conscience is informed and makes good decisions and is appropriately sensitive. So this doesn't work all by itself. All right. Some people might say that you can pick from among these systems, and I've seen this actually in an IEEE journal on discussing ethics. The idea is that they would say that sometimes one of these methods works better than another, so you have to evaluate them on a case-by-case basis and pick the one that works the best. Kind of see what would be the result of using each one of these ethical systems, and then line them all up on the table and say, well, I think that one's the best, I'll pick that one. But the question is, on what basis would you pick from among them? If you have some way of lining them up and ordering them from best to worst, then you have a new absolute that allows you to order them. So then you're really not operating with a single absolute system. Then you have another kind of ethical system altogether. So that doesn't really make sense from the case of a single absolute system. So make sure okay. So now let's talk about systems with many absolutes. There are a couple of different approaches to this. One is called conflicting absolutism, and the other is graded absolutism or hierarchicalism. So some of these are actually advocated by Christians, and non-Christians might as well, depending on their perspective. So from a Christian perspective, we might say due to the fall. But a non-Christian might have some other reason why there are inevitable conflicts in absolutes. But from a Christian perspective, due to the fall, there are inevitable conflicts in absolutes, and therefore you should choose the lesser of evils. Okay. Now the problem with this is that it implies that sin is unavoidable. In any given situation, you'd be forced to sin if you were just picking the lesser of evils. Now you might pick the lesser sin, but you'd still be picking a sin. But if sin is really unavoidable, then it's not really a moral choice anymore. It's not a moral issue anymore. The bullet isn't sinning by going into somebody's body, because the bullet was not choosing that. And if the best you can do is choose something that is bad, then really that's not a choice anymore. And therefore it's not really a moral issue. In fact, I believe we can make a case from the Bible that this situation can't happen, that you're never forced to, into sin. The Bible tells us that Jesus was tempted in every way and never sinned. It doesn't mean Jesus faced every single temptation that everybody faces, but every category, every type of temptation, and including difficult ethical dilemmas, I'm sure, and didn't sin. All right, so I have a real problem with that one because of these points. And there's another one called graded absolutism, and it's kind of the same thing, recognizes that there are real conflicts in absolutes, but they are ordered, or they're in a hierarchy, so that it's not a sin to violate one of the lower absolutes if it's necessary to keep a higher one. So it kind of defines sin in such a way that if you keep the higher one and violate the lower one, it's not really sin anymore. But some of the same criticisms come here. First of all, I don't believe that a true conflict is possible between absolutes, because I think that ethical principles are rooted in God's nature. God does not contradict himself. He's not at war within his own nature. And so these various ethical principles that come from God are harmonious, because God's nature is harmonious. And the problem is simply in our own understanding of them, or our application of them. Now, another problem with this is that this idea masks the idea that there's really a single absolute, kind of operating behind the scenes, and that's what allows you to order all the absolutes. So it's almost like a single absolute system in disguise. And we've already critiqued those. Because then if you order them, they're not really absolutes anymore. The one thing that's absolute is the order. The rest of them aren't absolute because there's all these exceptions for the higher ones. Okay. So here's what I believe is makes the most sense. That there is, in a sense, one absolute, and from another perspective, there are many absolutes. This perspective is called unqualified absolutism. And the way to state that I would state this is that there are many absolutes that do not conflict when properly understood, all of which find their unity in supreme love to God and love to neighbor as self. Okay? So there are many absolutes, that's the many part, that don't conflict, and all of them find a unity in love to God and love to neighbor as self. So in a way, it's one absolute, that is loving God and your neighbor. And in a way, it's many, depending on how you would flesh those out in specific ways. Things like not murdering and killing and whatever the specific, say, the Ten Commandments, for example. Okay? So, let me talk a little bit about that, why this makes sense. First of all, I believe it's grounded in the revelation of the Bible. The Bible talks about this overarching principle of love to God and neighbor, but also lots of specific absolutes in there, like the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule and things like that. It does not force man to be omniscient, like utilitarianism does, where we have to somehow predict the future or can somehow see all the possible consequences of our actions. Instead, it forces us to rely on God to define the greatest good, forces us to rely on Him to describe the highest kind of love, and so on. We let God do that defining. And He gives us things that are accessible to us to make our decisions on. We'll leave the results or the consequences to Him. And I believe, from a Christian perspective, there's no ultimate conflict between our duty and our happiness. Now, in a short-term sense, there very well may be. Okay? I may have to look the other way instead of cheat off of my neighbor's paper. And I may get a lower grade because of that. And you might say, well, that is a conflict between my duty and my happiness. But no, not in an ultimate sense. Ultimately, I'm going to be happier. And I'm not talking about, ha, 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 you know, the next 3 minutes kind of, that kind of happy. I'm talking about in some ultimate sense happy. I'm going to be happier. I'm going to be more satisfied. I'm going to find greater joy and satisfaction in my life if I don't cheat than if I do. So in an ultimate sense, there's no conflict between those two. And it also speaks to the outside and the inside. It requires both ethical actions and ethical motives. The highest ethical motive being love. So I think this fits very well with the things that we said before. Now, one of the things that's key to a Christian perspective on ethics is that it speaks, as I said just a moment ago, it speaks not just to the outward actions, but it speaks to the motives. It speaks to the heart. And we always kind of talk about this in, when we discuss ethics in our curriculum committee and stuff like that. We realize that you can put all the ethics in the curriculum that you want to, and you're not going to make somebody ethical by studying ethics. You go take a class on ethics and you walk out being ethical. That doesn't work that way. You might understand the principles of ethics better, but it doesn't make you ethical. Christianity teaches that no one can be truly ethical apart from a change of heart, because it's not just about the outside. It's about the inside. It's about whether a person is motivated by love for God and his or her neighbor, for the glory of God, and those kinds of things. So only actions that are done with love to God and a desire for His glory are truly ethical. So you might come up with the right outward decision about whether to install this safety harness in a truck or whatever. And you might come up with the right decision, but if you were not motivated by love to God and a desire for His glory, it wasn't ethical in the inward sense. It might have been ethical in the outward sense. And that can only come from a Christian perspective by what Jesus does, because only Jesus can bring about this radical change of heart that is required to be ethical on the inside as well as the outside. And I'd be glad to talk to anybody more about this later if you'd like. Scripture says, I'll put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God and they shall be my people. It's one of the principles of Christianity. So let me just very quickly step through some points here about resolving ethical dilemmas, because I think this might be helpful. As we think about ethical dilemmas, we need to recognize up front that there are some right choices that have agonizingly difficult consequences. Very often, the right thing to do isn't really that obscure. We know what the right thing to do is most of the time. It's just hard. Like I go back to the cheating example. We know it's not right to steal answers off of somebody else's paper. But hey, you know, my A is riding on whether I can get an A on this exam. And I don't want to be. Maybe that's going to be the difference in me getting kicked out of school or not. That's a difficult consequence of doing the right thing. But that's not an ethical problem, is it? That's just a problem of, do you have the motivation to do what you know is right? It's not a matter of figuring out what is right. It's just a matter of doing it. So I think that's where about 90% of this stuff is. It has to do with just being able to follow through on a right choice. Another thing, that principle, is that some dilemmas are only hypothetical. You know, the one about the roommate showing up, or the guy showing up with the gun threatening your roommate. Usually the options that are presented to you are: A, tell the truth and your roommate gets a bullet in the head, or B, tell a lie and the roommate is saved. Okay? How in the world do we know that those are going to be the consequences of those two actions?
There are many other choices there. Wrestle the gun out of his hand, maybe. Don't answer at all. Say something that is true, but maybe doesn't give all the information. Just say, I haven't seen my roommate in the last 3 hours. Well, that's true. Now, you know he's back there playing with his Wii in his room, but you don't have to tell him that. That criminal is not owed that kind of information. You can just say, I haven't seen him in the last 3 hours. That's true. Okay? There are lots of other things that you could do in that situation. So a lot of times the dilemmas that are presented to us are just hypothetical. I think sometimes dilemmas spring from a faulty interpretation of the Bible, where we think that the Bible obligates us to something when it doesn't. And just for time's sake, I won't unpack that one. But when we rightly understand what the Bible requires of us, then it may not be a dilemma at all. As I understand it, the positive duties that we have are actually stewardships. They're not absolute commands. The positive duties that we have are stewardships. That is, we do them to the best of our ability within our resources and within our role in life and that sort of thing. But they are to be pursued within the bounds of the thou shalt nots. So let me give you an example. The Bible says, you shall not kill. Okay? Now some people, and I would agree with this, understand that to say that that's a statement about God's view of life, human life. And so you can turn that around and say God very greatly values human life. And so I have a duty then to help preserve human life. And that's true. I think that's the flip side of that commandment. If God hates killing, then he loves preserving life. Okay? But at this very moment, someone probably in the Auburn-Opelika area might be, their life might be in danger. Maybe somebody's committing a robbery right now. Maybe somebody is in cardiac arrest. If I took that idea of preserving life to the point where it was an absolute, then I'd have to be out there right now looking, you know, kind of like Spider-Man or something, patrolling the streets, just looking for somebody to stop a crime or something. But that's not my job. Now, if I knew specifically that there was a situation or something, then that might override the fact that I'm doing a lecture in here. But since I don't know that, and my job here is to be a professor, your job is to be a student, here we are, and that's okay. We're not police officers, we're not Spider-Man, and so our job isn't to go out there and do that all the time. So that's kind of how I would weigh those out. On the other hand, not killing someone is, and I understand that to mean not murdering someone, doesn't apply to, we could talk about this, but I don't believe it applies to things like self-defense or a soldier in battle or something like that. But that's an absolute. It's never okay to murder someone. Okay, so the positive duties work within that. And then the last thing I would just say is that it's important not to try to wing it, because there are some really difficult ethical dilemmas. This whole stem cell thing is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of medical ethics. I think it's very likely that most of you will face a difficult medical ethical decision when it comes to your parents or grandparents or something like that, or maybe a child or something, where you have to decide whether to continue to put them on life support or pull the plug or whatever, because we've gotten so sophisticated now in our medicine that we can often prolong biological life for a long time. And so we have to wrestle through these kinds of things, and it's coming for most of us. You've got two parents, four grandparents, may have how many ever children, and everybody dies, and most people die in the hospital, and so that's a kind of decision that almost everybody faces at some point. Don't try to figure that out on your own. There are a lot of smart people and a lot of good people who have been thinking about that for a lot longer than you have, and that's just one example, but there are many things like that we should tap into the wisdom of others and the Bible.
Okay, so finally, the standard ethical systems all have elements of truth, but also have serious shortcomings. I believe Christian ethics provides an explanation for people being ethical, as well as for the ethical dilemmas that we face. Christian ethics provides a justification for ethical authority. It actually tells us why we're obligated. And I believe Christ provides not only a system, and that would be, you would get the wrong idea if you walked out of here thinking that Christianity is just a system of ethics. Christ does provide, in a sense, a system of ethics, but he also provides enablement to become ethical inside and out. And I believe that, and part of why I'm talking about this here in an engineering building and an engineering optional seminar, is because I believe that Christian ethics is a coherent option, a logical option in the marketplace of ideas. If we can talk about secular or naturalistic ethics in our ethics class, we ought to be able to talk about this as another option. And so that's why I talk about it here. All right, so that's all I wanted to say. And I went a little longer than I meant to, so I hope I didn't put anybody in a bind with that. But if anybody has questions or comments or anything you'd like to...